Okay, please turn your Bibles to the book of 1 Samuel, and I'm going to read a bit from 1 Samuel chapter 24. We talked last week about the life of Saul and the life of David, and their two lives are intertwined. So Saul is still alive, but in this part of the book, the main focus is on David as he runs from Saul. We talked a little bit about this last week as David is fleeing from Saul, who is jealous or envious, I guess, depending on which way you want to look at it, of David and his popularity. And this is in chapter 24, the first time in which, the first time in which he spares Saul's life. And I'm going to read part of this starting in 1 Samuel chapter 24. So Saul comes into a cave where David is hiding in the wilderness. And it says, starting in verse 4, "Then the men of David said to him," so Saul is in his cave. Saul is in the cave. David is hiding in the cave. Of course, Saul doesn't know David is there. "The men of David said to him, 'This is the day of which the Lord said to you, Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.' And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.' So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. David also arose afterward, went out of the cave and called out to Saul, saying, 'My lord the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, Indeed, David seeks your harm? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. But my eyes spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. Yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? Therefore, let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case, and deliver me out of your hand." And the verses that follow describe the reaction of Saul, who understands something of what David has done in sparing his life, and Saul weeps, and I won't read that part of the description. But this portion of David's life where he's fleeing from Saul is the setting for many of the Psalms. And you can tell that just from the titles of the Psalms in many cases, but also from the content where you see David fleeing from his enemy. So I want to come back to this idea in verse 15, "Let the Lord be judge and judge between you and me," because that comes up in the Psalms. But this description is striking because David has been anointed as king, but he respects the situation as it is, that is, Saul is still functioning as king. And David will not reach out his hand to kill the Lord's anointed. He even feels remorse for cutting off a corner of his robe. So careful is he to do what's right before the Lord. Now, part of the point of reading this is for us to see that David is not a vengeful person. David certainly could have sought vengeance on God at a human level, on Saul at a human level. because Saul had unjustly treated him. And yet he acknowledges that God will be the just judge in verse 12. And this a similar sort of question comes up in the next chapter, chapter 25. I'm not going to go through all these chapters this slowly, but the account of David with Nabal and with Nabal's wife Abigail is a very striking one. So David is just in the wilderness with a band of men, and he does various things, including protecting his own people from the Philistines and from others who would disturb the peace of Israel. And his group, his band, had performed this service of protection for this man Nabal, who was a wealthy man. And yet, when they sought some refreshment from Nabal, some provisions, Nabal dealt with them harshly. So let me read part of the description here. Nabal says in verse 10, in answer to David's request, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away, each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed from my shearers and give it to men when I do not know where they are from? So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Now here you see David acting in an uncharacteristic way, and by God's providence he's restrained by the gracious and very wise words of Nabal's wife. It says in verse 14, some of the young men told Abigail, who's Nabal's wife, what had happened. And you can read through the verses that follow to describe their own appeal to her and the justice of David's request. And Abigail then, in verses 18 and following, gathers together provisions to go to David. And she meets him in the wilderness. But before she gets there, there's an account of what David is thinking. Again, this is uncharacteristic, but it's worth reading to see what the natural reaction might be. Verse 21, now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed to the ground. So she fell at his feet and said, on me, my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. His name literally means fool. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. And it shall come to pass, when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good he has spoken concerning you, and is appointing you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt with well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. And David graciously responds. He shows the heart of God's people, as in contrast to Saul's heart when confronted with sin. He repents immediately from it and blesses God and even blesses the messenger of God who in effect Nabal, Abigail was in this case, as it says in verse 34, "As the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to me, surely by morning light no males would have been left to Nabal." Now the case that she makes is beautifully stated, and she even uses the picture of the enemies being shot from a sling, which of course would have been familiar from the story of Goliath, as well as the beautiful picture of David's life and the life of all of God's own being bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. So she argues that he should not have this blood on his hands when he comes into his own, and she's sure that he will. In verse 28, "The Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house," that is, a dynasty is guaranteed to David. Now, as I said, these are important because not only is this period of David's life the context of many of the Psalms, but throughout many of the Psalms that we sing, you see the same sort of plea as that I noted in chapter 24, "Let the Lord judge between you and me." It's chapter 24, verse 12. "And let the Lord avenge me on you." And it may cause question to ask, why is it that the Lord chose in his providence to reveal in the Psalms this sort of plea, this reminder that we should look to God as the one who brings justice? Well, maybe we'll talk about that more when we get to the survey of the Psalms, but let me briefly say that first, when David prays that God would avenge him, David is not avenging himself. And that's a point which is easily lost on us. We may see those cries for vengeance as coming from a vengeful spirit, that is, a self-avenging spirit. But David was refusing to take vengeance for himself, and he was committing it into God's hands. And that's what the Psalms are about. The Psalms don't encourage a, "oh, well, it doesn't really matter" attitude. That is, whether justice is done or injustice is done, it doesn't matter. God's word never encourages that kind of attitude, but it does discourage us seeking vengeance when it's not our calling. Obviously, the civil magistrate, in a sense, works the vengeance of God in the appropriate circumstance. But here, the spirit that's encouraged is exactly the spirit that Abigail reminds David that he had and calls him to have in that circumstance. But there's something beyond just the fact that David is being pursued by his enemies in the wilderness and that they are seeking to kill him. And to get a little bit of that, I want to flip ahead flip ahead to chapter 26 and verse 19. This is the second time when David has spared Saul's life, and I won't look at it in detail. But in verse 19, there's a very striking statement of David about his own situation. David, remember, is on the run. It's not like he's chosen to, you know, have a cabin in the wilderness just to get away for a weekend. He has been driven out because Saul pursues him. And it says in verse 19, David is addressing Saul, "Now therefore, please let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" You see, there's another factor here other than the mere physical threat to David's life. And that is the cutting off from the people of God, which was the effect of Saul's attempt to kill David. Now, whether other people actually said to David, "Go serve other gods," isn't really the point. What he's saying is that, in effect, Saul's evil counselors and Saul's own intentions have driven him out from the inheritance of the Lord. Now, again, this may be hard for us to relate to, but you have to keep in mind that at that point, he was living among the Philistines. Right? He couldn't go to church in Gath, as it were. And it wasn't just moving from one place to another and he could find a different fellowship to be involved in. God in his wisdom had set his worship at a particular place, and his people were gathered in a particular nation. And to be cut off from those people, as he was to be cut off from the inheritance of God, was in effect to be excommunicated, although It wasn't a judicial excommunication. In a sense, he was driven out from the fellowship of God's people. And he was, in effect, put then in a place of temptation. He was living in an idolatrous country. I mean, the Philistines were no worshipers of the true God. They were serving other gods. And so, in effect, he's saying, you have put a snare before me. You have driven me out of my own people, you or your evil counselors. He's very gracious and not accusing Saul directly, but referring to evil counselors. He's saying, in effect, you have attempted not only to destroy me physically, but also to destroy me spiritually, in effect, by putting me putting this temptation in front of me. Now, it's important to realize both those aspects, which I tried to emphasize in the Exodus also, that God's people in Egypt were not only oppressed physically, but they were in a land of idolatry, and therefore, in their case, they actually fell into the temptation to worship other gods. This is important because you see that when David in the Psalms is pleading for God to show justice, it's not merely David as an individual person, but David as God's anointed. And David then, from that perspective, is seen as one whom Satan is seeking to destroy. David is the one through whom the Messiah, the promised seed, is supposed to come. And Satan is, in effect, driving him out and threatening him both physically and, as it were, and spiritually by cutting him off from God's inheritance. And so that raises the level of the drama in the Psalms from a mere threat from physical enemies who are, you know, hounding David. These are not people who just stepped on his toe or stole a car from him or something like this. These are people who are seeking to snuff out the line of the Messiah. And that's the significance in many cases of what we sing in the Psalms. And so that's part of the reason why we can enter into it, even if we're not wandering around in Gath. Okay, I mean, you know, there are churches in what's equivalent to Gath now. It's not obviously the same sort of situation. But we too pray that God would cut off the enemies of his kingdom, and that Satan's designs to destroy the church would be frustrated, that God would take vengeance in that sense. Well, as I said, I think we'll come back to that more later, but I've already argued before that there's plenty of evidence in the Old Testament that the people of God were not to take vengeance for themselves. It's not simply a New Testament teaching. In fact, as I pointed out, when Paul in Romans 12 wants to argue that the people of God should love their enemies, the best place he can turn is to the Old Testament to prove his point. But let me pause here and see if you have any questions or comments on that. That was too provocative. David.
This distinction between taking vengeance and exercising self-defense is a difficult one for quite a few people, because the idea that God is our avenger and he is the one to right those past wrongs is a very difficult concept, I think, in terms of making distinctions. The idea that we should just turn the other cheek and Christians are to be mowed down, if that's the way it tends to work out. And when we see David as a fighting man at times, in battle,
sure.
But at other times he stays his hand because he sees it's not his place to do these things.
Yeah, and I think that last comment is especially helpful. Americans have lost any sense of, in many cases, for what our place and what our calling is. You know, we can all do whatever anyone can do. We can take the law in our own hands. Sometimes people jump to that conclusion. But David understood that he wasn't king. He understood that when he was king, that was part of God's calling, was to lead the army or to exercise capital punishment, whatever it may be. It is the case that people tend to go to two extremes, either to be hot-headed or to be so passive as to just say, well, you know, I don't care what happens. But the will of the Lord for all of his servants is not either of those.
But the very idea that someone could be, you can get the picture that in the Old Testament, they were really, it was just a bloodlust.
Yeah, right.
There was no concept of living decently among others.
Right.
And if you turn to a passage to state the name, you say, well, you see
there you go. Yeah.
He just couldn't hardly stay his name.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that he would have been following the practice of other cultures around him if he had done that, but certainly the revealed will of God was different. Okay. I'd like to look now at the remainder of the book, and I'm going to try to have to go over this quickly. I actually want to get all the way up to the Davidic covenant, although we won't talk about it. So the last several chapters of the book of 1 Samuel, starting in chapter 27 and onward, really culminate in the death of Saul, which is a sad event. And they are paralleled in part by the book of 1 Chronicles. So 1 Chronicles 10 starts with the description of the actual death of Saul. And so in that sense, there's some overlap between there is some overlap between 1 Chronicles 10 through 16 and what we'll be looking at from now on. Now, David flees to the Philistines again, and he's among them. And then the story goes back to Saul. Now, Saul, in chapter 28, consults a medium. We talked about this a little bit last time. But Saul, it says in verse 6 of chapter 28, could not find any word from God. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Now, this is the sort of situation that's strictly forbidden in the law. And strikingly, in that context in Deuteronomy where the forbidding of seeking mediums is given, there is an emphasis that God himself will reveal a word. God will send his prophet. Saul, because of his wickedness, has that means cut off from him. And if I could make a bit of an extended footnote here, this is, in a sense, Saul's own fault. Now, certainly you can see it's Saul's own fault because of his rebellion against God, and because he has refused to listen to the word of God. But I mean it in a slightly more specific sense. If we had read more carefully the chapters I just took a low fly over, then you would realize that again and again David is inquiring of the Lord. And it says specifically that in connection with the ephod. So if you look, for example, in chapter 30, verse 7, I realize this is flipping ahead, but this is a direct mention of this. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired with the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? Now, I'm not telling you the context in terms of what's going on there, but just the fact that David makes use of this ephod to inquire of the Lord. How was it in David's hands? Well, it was in David's hands because Saul ordered the slaughter of the priests. David was fleeing from Saul, and he went to where the high priest was, and the high priest gave him aid, and word later came back to Saul. That's actually specifically one of the subjects of the Psalms. This Doeg brings word back to Saul, and Saul orders the slaughter of the priests. One priest escapes, actually the son of the high priest escapes, and that's this Abiathar, and he takes with him this ephod. It's not clear exactly how that functioned, but it was apparently a means by which God revealed his will. And so you can see a direct connection in verse 6 when Saul is unable to get a word from God with the fact that that was gone from him. Although apparently there's still a mention of the Urim here in verse 6. Now, I won't go through the story of the medium with Saul. Saul wants this medium to call up Samuel. And more than one commentator has pointed out how strange it is that Saul, who refused to listen to Samuel in his life, wanted to call up Samuel after he was dead. I mean, there's actually this description of that our Lord gives in the New Testament of Lazarus and the rich man. You know, this guy, well, maybe someone will come from the dead. There's this strange attitude that that people sometimes have. But Saul's desire to speak to Samuel, the woman at the end agrees to. Typically, at least historically, Reformed commentators have been very skeptical that this is actually, that she is actually able to call Samuel back from the dead. and have historically said that this was a satanic deception. You should remember what Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2 about Satan's, he calls his wonders lying wonders. And that's likely what's going on here. In any case, the effect of the words that are given here in verses 16 that this vision gives to the woman are to drive Saul to despair. And that, in fact, is the way, of course, Saul ends his life. He's wounded in battle and unwilling to be found by the Philistines. He kills himself. He falls on his own sword. That's the sad end, then, of Saul's life. And I skipped and went over that fairly briefly. But at the same time as Saul is killed, so is Jonathan, who is, of course, in covenant with David. And that's another sad part of the story. In the meanwhile, there are interesting things going on with David. This is a kind of a fascinating part of the story because David, who had been hanging out with the Philistines and at the same time not taking the part of the Philistines, suddenly finds himself lined up on the wrong side of battle, and that is, to fight against his own people. And in God's providence, at the last minute, he's relieved of that duty. And he goes off and rescues his own people. I guess I feel I must push on past that. So let's flip over from the end of 1 Samuel to 2 Samuel. As I said before, there were originally one book, so the transition there is not as great as it may seem. Yes?
Just, you talked about what commentators have said regarding Saul and his medium. John Trapp had some witty comments about this passage when he said that Saul went to communicate with Samuel and the devil appears and preaches his funeral sermon.
Yeah, that's what it turns out to be. That's right.
How do you interpret verse 19 where Samuel basically says, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me? He was the anointed of the Lord. He failed.
There are different ways that could be understood. Often, with me is simply to refer to the place of death, that is, they will be in the grave. If it is, in fact, as I was suggesting, a satanic deception, then it would be simply Satan's giving Saul either a false assurance or just saying that he would be killed. I don't think it would be right. I don't think we should take it to say that Saul will be with Samuel in the presence of God, in fellowship with God. There, I think the fact. Anyway, that's enough stuff. Okay, in 2 Samuel, there's a follow-up at the beginning of the book, which I will only touch on briefly, about the death of Saul and Jonathan. And again, you see the heart of David is shown very clearly here. Here's a man who sought to destroy David. And David laments is the death not only of Jonathan, but also of Saul. I'm looking at 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 17. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan. And the lamentation is given in the verses that follow. So much was he committed to this principle of not touching the Lord's anointed that when someone came to him claiming to have done in Saul, that David orders that he be killed. So in verse 14, again, of 2 Samuel 1, David said to him, this is the one who had claimed that he had put Saul to death, how was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Now, it's probably the case that this one who came to David thought he would be rewarded for his story, and apparently from the account at the end of 1 Samuel, it was just a story, that is, he was claiming something he had not accomplished. Although it's not exactly clear. In any case, you see again David's respect for the authority of God's anointed and his refusal not only to kill him, but also his judgment on the one who did. And that's executed in verse 15. So, following this, in chapters 2 and on, there's a bit of a confused situation in the kingdom. David is appointed as king over Judah, which would be his own tribe. For 7.5 years, he rules simply as king over Judah. And that's the description of that is in chapter 2. But there is war with Saul's house. Abner, who was the commander of the armies under Saul, sets up someone else, Ishbosheth, a son of Saul, in verse 10 is described. And he rules, it says in verse 10, over the house of Israel. So at this intermediate period, there's a strife between David and his commander, who is Joab, and Abner, who is the former ruler, the former commander under Saul, and now is alive with this Ishbosheth. And in the end, it's a complicated story, but Abner decides that he will go over to David's side, but before this is really accomplished fully, Joab kills him. And it's a striking thing, again, to see David's attitude toward this. And I've lost my place. Yeah, okay, sorry. It's at the end of chapter 3 where the attitude of David toward this death is described. And he says in verse 35, when all the people came to persuade David to eat food while it was still day, he was mourning over the death of Abner. David took an oath, saying, God do so to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people in all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. This emphasizes, by the way, that even a king can't accomplish all of his will. And he realized that he in that case, was not able to deal with Joab as he should. In the end of his life, he saw the opportunity in his son Solomon. So David is anointed king over all of Israel, and that's starting in chapter 5 in the opening verses there. There's a description in verse 3 of, well, it says, therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. So the kingdom is reunited after a period of some civil war, and this is the beginning then of the reign of David, which occupies the rest of the book of 2 Samuel. Now, the chapters that follow, and I'm only going to look at part of what follows here. That is, I think we'll have to wait for the covenant with David to talk about that next week. But you can see in chapters 5 and 6 the establishment of David's own kingdom in the sense first that he conquers the city of Jerusalem. Now, there had been mentioned before, I think it was even in Joshua, that the Israelites had not conquered the city of Jerusalem. Maybe it was in the beginning of Judges. The Jebusites still dwelt there. And David was able to conquer the city. This is an interesting thing just from a military point of view and the way the city is situated. It was fairly easy to defend the city. But it says in verse 8, now David said on that day, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Therefore they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. This was, I read this a little bit out of context. In verse 6, they were saying, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the Jebusites, were saying, there's no way anyone can take this. The blind and the lame could defend this city from David. And that's the context of David's statement. And yet he does, in the end, conquer the city. And there's a sense of completion just in this part of it. And let me read verses 9 and 10, then, picking up where I stopped. But David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all round from the Milo and inward, the Millo and inward. And David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. Then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. You see the blessing now of the king. God had turned a blessing into a curse into a blessing. So just to pick up with this again with the thread we tried to set before, the people desired to have a king of their own, but they desired it with the wrong attitude, and they desired it rejecting God as their king. So initially God gave them a king, but a king who was a wicked and rebellious king. And then it was still, of course, God's original intention, in fact, his promise from the beginning to give them a faithful ruler. And so you can see in verse 12 the culmination of that. He, God, had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. Here is for the sake of their blessing, because David was a good king and a faithful one. And so God intends good for his people and blesses them through David. Now, the after having his, as it were, his house established in the sense of a physical dwelling place and a place to rule, David's thought turns immediately to the worship of God. And the worship of God, especially as it's concerned with the ark. Now, we had picked up the story of the ark for a while. It had gone from the people of God at Shiloh into battle in a superstitious way. And the Philistines found out they didn't really want it with them and sent it back. But the ark had never really returned to its central place. That is, the ark and the tabernacle were actually never reunited. And so David's desire is to bring the ark out of where it had been in a temporary place up to the city of God. And let me read beginning in chapter 6 of the description of that. Again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, whose name is called by the name, the Lord of hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. So they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, who was on the hill. And Uzziah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart. There's a description there of what follows from this situation. In verse 4, and they brought it out of the house of God, out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, accompanying the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord on all kinds of instruments of fir wood, on harps, on stringed instruments, on tambourines, on sistrums, and on cymbals. And when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah. And he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" And then he makes a second attempt. And I think instead of looking at that second attempt here, I'd like for us to turn over to the parallel passage in Chronicles. So 1 Chronicles chapter, it covers two chapters. Let's turn directly to 1 Chronicles 15. I mentioned that part... Well, we've come to the part of Samuel and then later Kings, which is parallel to parts of the book of Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 13 begins the description that we read of Uzzah. excuse me. But it concludes the story in the second attempt in chapter 15. Let me read what David's analysis on reflection of what had happened was. David calls for those who were originally appointed by the law to carry the Ark of God. So, example, in the chapter 15, verse 2, then David said, "No one may carry the Ark of God but the Levites, for the Lord has chosen them to carry the Ark of God and to minister before him forever." And then picking it up in verse 12, he said to them, that is, he had gathered the priests and Levites for this work, and these are the ones he's addressing, "You are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the Ark of the Lord God of Israel to the place I have prepared for it. For because you did not do it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not consult him about the proper order." Now, this is a striking lapse in David's work as a man of God. I already mentioned how consistently he consulted God in the time of battle. And yet, here he acknowledges that he did not consult God. And the results of it are very striking, aren't they? Uzzah is stricken dead. Now, this seems like kind of an extreme judgment. And Calvin has a series of sermons on 2 Samuel. I just lost my place. And he makes a comment about this. He says, "We have here a very strange story. When a man attempting to honor God," he's speaking about Uzzah, I think particularly, although David could be included, "a man attempting to honor God, burning with a good and holy devotion, was punished like a criminal. Now this certainly offends our feelings. We know that the main cause of offending God is our wicked will. It is the root of all sins and of the contempt that we have for God, which makes us rebels against him, so that we cannot subject ourselves to the rule which he gives us. But on the other hand, when our desire is to glorify him, and we have no ill will in us, even if we have erred and made a mistake, still it seems that God ought not to hold it against us, especially when we do not willfully get out of line or go beyond the will which he gave us." I think Calvin expresses well our reaction in reading a story like this. You don't want the ark to fall on the ground, do you? How could this happen? Well, first of all, of course, it happens because God is a holy God, and Uzzah has no place putting out his hand to touch the Ark of God. But although it's true, it is true that God is a holy God, certainly, it's particularly true that God showed his holiness in connection with the regulation of his own worship. And I made this point when we were looking at the setting up of the government of the theocracy, if you want to call it that, originally. So I emphasized the liberty which it gave to God's people. There was also the corresponding fact that God alone had the right to rule and to direct them. And that's particularly the point here, and it's striking that it's God's holiness is emphasized in connection with Nadab and Abihu, who were stricken for failing to follow God's own regulations. It was God's holiness, God said, that should be particularly before their eyes. And that is, I think, the reminder of this account as well. It was because they had not consulted God. Even though they were acting with zeal and, you might say, all good intentions, that this happened. So let me read again what Calvin says to describe why this happens. He actually has a very helpful discussion, and I'm only reading part of it. He says, "Moreover, we must gather from it that none of our devotions will be accepted by God unless they are conformed to his will. This rule ruins all the man-made inventions in the papacy's so-called worship of God, which has so much pomp and foolishness." Calvin is not politically correct, and that's just to say that, but that's what he says. "All of that is nothing but sheer trash before God, and is in fact an abomination to him. Hence, let us hold this unmistakable rule, that if we want to worship God in accordance with our own ideas, it will simply be abuse and corruption. And so, on the contrary, we must have the testimony of his will in order to follow what he commands us and to submit to it. Now, that is how the worship which we render to God will be approved." Well, this this is sort of a negative note in which to conclude our study this morning. God has brought David from wandering in the wilderness, where he was faithful to follow after God, where he restrained himself from taking vengeance on his enemies, where Satan, as I stress, in a sense was exiling him and seeking to destroy him, to this place where he's established in his kingdom. And this one act of putting the ox on a new cart is, Calvin actually, I said he develops the point very well. He points out that the worship of God at that point had been so neglected, it was almost as if they were starting anew. They didn't have before them a history of how God was supposed to be worshipped. The priests had been corrupt. The line of Eli had been, if not completely cut off by Saul's actions, almost cut off. Although that's no excuse, it still helps to put in perspective how David could still be freshly appointed as king. And in the next chapter, in chapter 7, which we didn't get to this morning, receives this gracious covenant and the promise that his line would rule and through him the Messiah would come. So I want to close on that note. It is important to remember God's own holiness and the way he will be worshipped. It's also important to remember God's faithfulness when men stumble to accomplish his purpose. And it's a remarkable thing to look at David wandering through the wilderness. You know, he's on one side of the mountain. Saul's on the other side of the mountain. He's that close to death, and yet God preserves him, and God establishes him in the end. That gives a lot of force to the Psalms we sing. If when David talks about God's deliverance, it's a remarkable thing. Any comments or questions?
Yeah. It's, as we look at Judges, we see the failure, basically, of leadership and the priesthood. And we see a restoration here of leadership and the proper order of worship. And it's only by chance that we don't have a place named Perez, Ohio, right? Because, I mean, just imagine, I don't think it was personal against Uzzah. I think the point that these things happened before,
that's good
for our benefit. I mean, if you see God, who's going to be, which way is he going to rock? There's only thing to determine who's in or out. It wasn't personalized to Uzzah. I think it was really against David. And he really, the priesthood, again, needed to come in. That's what happens, and so there's an interim here between Chronicles 13 and 15, when the second attempt was made, and that the proper order has now been set on the priesthood side. So God's going to have his way in both the kingdom and in the priesthood.
Very good. Very good. I thought of Perez, Ohio, but that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, that's right. And you can see David almost pouting at first over, how is the ark going to come up to me? But then he does come to realize what you're saying, that this is part of what the whole thing is about, is to restore the worship of God and the calling of the priests to that work. Very good. Any other comments? Well, Lord willing, we'll look next week at the covenant with David. It may take more than 1 week. We'll see. Let's close in prayer.